weer by Sterre en Planete. Soos jy teen hierdie tyd seker al gehoor het, is die vader van hierdie program vroeg donderdagoggend oorlede op 82-jarige ouderdom. Vir die wat verlede Sondag se program misgeloop het, wil ek hoogs aanbeveel om die potgooi te gaan luister. Dit was 'n wonderlike idee van RSG bestuur toe hulle hoor Hennie se gesondheid gaan vinnig agteruit om vir ons te vra om 'n huldigingsprogram vir Hennie te doen, waar ons eintlik met hom praat terwyl ons oor hom praat. Dit het toe prachtig ingepas by die insetsel oor die geskiedenis van sterre en planete, wat ek en Hennie oorspronkelijk beplan het vir sy laaste program, waar hy as ware die leisel sou oorgee, wat ongelukkig toe nie kon gebeur nie, weens sy gesondheid wat so vannacht versleg het. Ons is baie verheug toe Ingrid, sy vrou, verlede sondag aand hierdie boodskap stuur. Hallo Willie, ons wil net dankie sê vir die prachtige program, jy het dit mooi goed saamgestel. So een mooie refleksie en Hennie het almal sy stemme herken. Ons het vir Hennie een radiokie geneem om vanaan die uitsending te hoor. Ons het sy kop en hande gestreel om te keer dat hy nie wegraak nie en hy het aandagtig geluister. Ek dink hy slaap vanaand baie lekker. Namens sy familie en die sterre en planete span wil ons almal bedank vir die boodskappe wat ingestroom het op die Facebookgroep, soveel so dat kommentaar automatisch afgeskakel het op van die plasings, weens die abnormale hoë verkeer. Hier is twee boodskappe wat ek graag wil aanhaal, wat my hart aangeraak het. En hy het nou sy aardse lichaam verlaat, verlos van pyn en ongemak, maar sy hemelse lichaam sal sondagaande steeds vir ons wink op ons reise deur die ruimte. Die skitterpad wat hy met sy kennis nagelaat het, sal ons nog lang deur die grootsheid van die heelal lei. Jou stem is stil, maar jou nalatenskap leef voort. Ons beplan een toekomstige huldigingsprogram, maar luister nou na een verkorte weergawe van die program wat ons vooraf opgeneem het, terwyl Hennie in ons gedagtes voortleef.
Goeienaand weer by Sterre en Planete. My naam is Willie Koorts en saam met ons vanaand is professor Matie Hofman van Bloemfontein. En soos gebruiklik, elke eerste sondag van die maand, gesels Jim Adams, voormalige adjunkt technische directeur by NASA hoofkwartier, alipad uit Amerika ook saam. Maar eers gesels ons met 'n sonsverduisteringsjagter. Dit is sommer my vry vertaling vir 'n eclipse hunter. Die meeste luisteraars is seker al in die media gesien van die groot algehele sonsverduistering wat môre oor Amerika gaan beweeg. En soos gewoonlik ook al die fopnuus wat daarmee saamgekom het. So net so 'n bietjie agtergrond. Maansverduistering is sigbaar van oral op die aarde waar die maan op is, maar sonsverduisterings werk anders. Omdat die maan se skaduwee op die aarde net 'n paar 100 kilometer in deesnee is en boonop voortbeweeg teen die spoed van 'n vegvliegtuig, is 'n algehele sonsverduistering slegs sigbaar langs 'n smal strook 'n paar duisend kilometer lank. Om 'n algehele sonsverduistering te beleef, moet jy jouself dus ergens in hierdie strook bevind. So as jy nie bereid is om te reis nie, moet jy ook bereid wees om te wag, want dit neem gemiddeld 330 jaar in die noordelike halfrond en 540 jaar dat het in jou dorp in die suidelike halfrond gaan gebeur. Die meeste mense beleef dalk een of twee in hulle leeftyd, maar soos jy nou gaan hoor, Paul Miley het al meer as 80 sonsverduisterings gesien. Ok Paul, I think we last met each other in Cape Town many many moons ago when you were on a cruise ship chasing after an eclipse. You were after wanting to see the space debris that was in the Science Center here in Cape Town. So it's been a long while. So what have you been up to and your company? What do you do to chase after eclipses?
Well, I don't own a company. I'm an amateur astronomer, and I've been a representative of the NASA Johnson Space Center Astronomical Society that's located in Houston, Texas, USA now for many years. I used to work there beginning just before the first Apollo moon landing, and I retired there 14 years ago. So I had a chance to spend a lot of time working at a location that really offered me a lot of opportunities and interesting experiences. My eclipse chasing is just one facet of that. So it has continued beginning in 1969 and ended when my jobs there terminated in 2010. But I've had, like I said, many different experiences. I've had some personal initiatives that I launched that NASA accepted, and those offered me some unique opportunities.
Wow, yes, that sounds really exciting. We need another recording one day again to start to capture some of this. So why is it necessary to actually chase after a solar eclipse?
Well, solar eclipses are probably one of the most interesting phenomena that one can see with the naked eye, as well as conduct research. The principal reason for representing the Astronomical Society is to conduct public outreach, that is, to expose as many people who are not amateur astronomers to what can be seen in the universe. And what better way than by bringing people to a total eclipse of the sun, or one that is not total, but equally impressive. And believe me, we have taken probably 4,000 people over the last many years on various trips. The group sizes I lead are anywhere from 15 to 300 people in size. And depending on the distance from the United States, we can take larger groups. And as we move farther away, we have to take smaller groups. So either way, a total eclipse presents an amazing experience, not only for people who want to see it visually, but people who want to photograph it or videotape it. It's just amazing. And these experiences are very fortunate because this is the only planet in the solar system that has a moon that is virtually the same size in the sky. If you put the moon and the sun together, they subtend the same angle. And you can't really find that in any other planet in the solar system. So it's because of this unique arrangement that began millions of years ago and will probably end in about 600 million years when the moon and the Earth gradually begin to separate. There will be no more total eclipses after that time.
So we do indeed live in a special time. So there's been all sorts of things in the news popping up on our news feeds about tomorrow's eclipse, and people ask, can we see it here in South Africa and whatever? And of course we now know, because you say it only subtends a very small strip on the Earth and you have to chase after it. What are your plans for tomorrow?
Well, tomorrow I plan to be on a ship that we have chartered that will be in the southwest portion of the Pacific Ocean, just between Lower Baja California and the Mexico coast. We will be the first people, actually, to see the eclipse. A shadow passes directly over our ship and then proceeds into Mexico and then through the United States and Canada. So it's interesting that the path across the world extends about 3,000 miles, but it's a very narrow path, only about 150 miles in width, and that varies depending upon the length of time that the eclipse takes to move across the globe. And as a result, we're going to be in a very lucky position, and hopefully the skies will be clear.
Yeah, so as having one eclipse under my belt back in 2002, I saw it from the northern parts of South Africa. Unfortunately, we were almost clouded out, and we were so lucky. It just opened up a little sucker hole, or a big enough sucker hole, to see the sun, and you can see the corona and whatever. So we experienced it okay, but not as well as it could. So how many have you seen, and how many were clouded out and successful, roughly?
Well, it's interesting that you asked that question and mentioned the 2002 eclipse, because while you were in South Africa, my wife and I were in Mozambique observing the same eclipse, and we had mostly cloudy skies as well. So we were very unlucky for that. But I've been observing eclipses for decades now, and I've attempted 83 wow. eclipses wow. of varying types. My percentage of cloud outs is probably 15%, while I've had success 85% of the time.
So obviously you put in a lot of planning before you just set out, especially if you set sail on an ocean liner or a cruise ship, because it costs money. So there's obviously a lot of planning that goes into this.
That is certainly true, and we try to use historical weather data. Mainly nowadays, we use satellite imagery for that particular day each year for perhaps the past 10 to 20 years, just to get an idea of the likelihood of clouds. But sometimes it works very well, and other times it doesn't. So, you know, one can put all the planning in the world into it, and you cannot guarantee that success will occur.
Yeah, and of course, climate change doesn't help either. So, have you got some interesting stories or memorable eclipses that you can recall?
Well, we've had a lot of different experiences. There was a total eclipse in Turkey in 1999, where the temperature was observed to drop about 20 degrees. And at that time, there was a considerable problem with Kurdish separatists who were causing problems in the area that we were in. And as a result, we had a police escort and an armored car located surrounding our site, protecting our group. We did not have any problems, as it turned out, but it made me very nervous to have that kind of presence in the area. But we were extremely successful, and I was very happy about that. So that's just one of a number of different experiences that we've had. For example, in 1983, we had a total eclipse on the island of Java in Indonesia, and being a relatively primitive area that we were in, and also a Muslim population that is probably the largest in the world in one country. We were located in a small village, and we had an escort of military police. At the time of the eclipse, there was a instructions broadcasted on a loudspeaker from a mosque nearby, and just as totality was about to begin, everyone locally disappeared, including the military police. And so myself and my colleague were left alone out there, which was not a problem, to observe this wonderful eclipse. And everybody else was inside, cowering, and did not come out until the total eclipse was over. So this was a very unfortunate incident for them because they missed this great opportunity, but it was based on their cultural belief system that, witnessing an eclipse was something to be avoided.
Well, that's amazing that in these modern times people can still be so superstitious because it sounds like almost medieval times.
But what I was going to add to that is this was the account in Indonesia was in 1983, so that's essentially 41 years ago. But last year, October 14th, we had an annular eclipse of the sun, which was visible in the state of Utah here in the United States. And the area we were in is in an indigenous American Indian reservation area called the Navajo Reservation. And their cultural belief systems today are absolutely identical. So all the offices of the Navajo Nation were shut down for that day. The national park, which encompasses some really amazing scenery, was shut down. And all of the people in the Navajo tribe were again told to stay indoors and not observe the eclipse. So this continues today in different parts of the world, even though we think that it shouldn't happen like that.
Wow, yeah, that almost reminds one of the days where wars were stopped by a solar eclipse. There's lots of stories going back a long time. Tell me something. The next total eclipse for South Africa is in November 2030.
That is correct, and I hope to be coming there for that, but I have not yet done my due diligence on the weather analysis to find out if South Africa or Namibia, which is at one end of the eclipse path, or southern Australia, which is at the other end of the eclipse path, or somewhere in the ocean in between, might have the best weather. And as soon as I do that, then I'll be able to make a decision on where I want to go.
Well, we hope you choose South Africa and we may even meet up again one day. Thank you very much, Paul. And we hope that you're going to see the eclipse or you're going to see nothing, I guess, which means that the sun will be blocked out completely from where you are tomorrow.
Well, we hope that will happen, and even if it was to be cloudy, we will still be underneath the moon's shadow, so it will get dark.
Okay, so now after hearing Paul's experience and his plans for the future, Jim, are you going to be anywhere tomorrow under the moon shadow?
Sadly, Vili, I'm not. I'm going to be in the Washington, D.C. area, and the forecast is for rain clouds. Plus, the line of totality doesn't go across this region. I have family in Cleveland, which will see 100% totality. But just due to personal plans, I'm not able to get over to Cleveland to stay with my family and see the eclipse this time around. Though I have many friends that are positioning themselves along the line of totality as it works its way across the North American continent.
Okay, great stuff. So just going around the room, so Jim, how many have you seen before and how many have you seen, Marty?
Oh, I think I've seen about a half a dozen.
Wow. Okay. And Marty?
Billy, I have seen the one of there in the northern part of South Africa, which was a fantastic experience. And once you have seen it, it's like looking at a try in a rugby test match, and then you wait to see it again, but you can't see it again. It was over in a few minutes, and of the few minutes, we could see the full open solar corona for only 30 seconds. I think you had a similar experience of seeing only part of the eclipse due to the clouds, but it was just fantastic that at the maximum of the eclipse, when that diamond ring effect showed up, there was a small hole in the clouds, and the diamond ring effect is due to sun rays skimming through valleys between the hills on the moon. So you have this darkness of the central part of the sun covered with the moon, and then the glow around like a ring, and then the effect of this bright diamond ring almost. That's why they call it the diamond ring effect. But the whole experience of the approach, so it's getting darker as due to this partial eclipse, but then the sudden effect when the dark shadow start to move over you, and it immediately gets cooler. The wind start blowing and the birds start to return to the trees because they think the sun is setting. So it's a very amazing experience. So that was my first total solar eclipse, and I'm really looking forward to what's a second for me in a lifetime opportunity on 25 November 2030. When the total solar eclipse path will move through the Free State. I think the biggest town near the path of totality in the Free State will be Kroonstad. So we will have to travel only a bit more than 200 kilometers, which is a very short distance to travel for that. But we should start to think about preparing for the visitors that should come and experience this, not only visitors from South Africa. Most people either are lucky get one opportunity in a lifetime. I think it happens about once in a few decades in South Africa that we have a total solar eclipse. And just to give an idea of what can happen with the upcoming solar eclipse, which will be tomorrow, the Niagara region around the Niagara Falls declared state of emergency because they expect 1 million people visiting them, far more on one day than the tourists that they receive over a full year. And that is a popular tourist destination.
Yeah, this is a special one cutting across the center of the United States, starting in southern Mexico and working its way across the Midwest and then exiting the shadow exits in the Northeast, as you mentioned, Niagara Falls, and then on into the Northeast. In fact, one of the most memorable eclipses that I saw was actually in South Africa. It was a partial solar eclipse that I saw, I believe it was February of 2017, in Leeuwenbosch-Fontein. I hope I didn't slaughter the name.
Oh, yes. Yes, yeah. Great.
And things I think that's really great about these eclipses is it is a gathering time for people who are interested in this sort of thing. And it's a fantastic opportunity to teach people about our solar system and how things orbit the sun and the dynamics between the Earth and the sun and the moon.
Yeah, and then also about the fact that on average, the apparent size of the moon or the angle that it's spent as seen from Earth is very, very close to that of the sun. They have the same angular size, and that is due to the fact that the moon is 400 times smaller than the sun, but it also happens to be approximately 400 times closer than the sun. So these two things exactly balance. And then you mentioned that where the shadow of the moon touches the Earth and then it goes at a high speed of a few hundred kilometers an hour, it sweeps over the Earth.
Yeah. It's also an interesting time to look at phenomena that we don't normally see associated with the sun, right? Now, we should warn people, even though you won't be seeing the eclipse that's up for tomorrow, that you should never look straight at the sun, right? There's ways to look at the sun safely. But obviously, you don't, even during an eclipse, when it seems like the light is lower, you shouldn't be looking straight at the sun. What the moon does is it blocks out the main disk of the sun, so everything gets darker. But sometimes the moon is just a little smaller, and so it leaves a little bit peeking out around the edges. And that's what we call the corona of the sun, which there's a lot of dynamics, a lot of plasma physics and magnetic interactions going on in the corona that these eclipses make opportunities for us to see. And one of the rare finds is if there happens to be a coronal mass ejection leaving the surface of the sun at the same time that there's an eclipse, and sometimes you can actually see on the edge of the sun, pieces of the sun that are getting ready to hurtle off into space.
Jim, what's remarkable in the 2017 eclipse that also moved over the United States, they had a few fighter jets that flew with the shadow so that right. It could observe the corona for quite a long time. So do you remember something about that experiment or observations?
I do. I don't remember the details, but I know that we had fighter jets trying to trace with the eclipse and take pictures for longer. Of course, there are ways that science instruments today make their own eclipses, right? And we call those coronagraphs. Some of them are on Earth-based telescopes. Billy, you might want to mention the one that's in South Africa. And many of the instruments that I've flown on some of my spacecraft have coronagraphs.
Yeah, so as you say, typically a coronagraph has got an artificial moon in the way, in the optical train, eh? And it will then block out the bright light from either the sun, if you're looking at the sun, or of a bright star in the field. So some very bright stars has got interesting scientific phenomena happening right next to them. Even exoplanets, for instance. So we have an instrument in Sutherland called a coronagraph, as the same thing that you've just mentioned that's on spacecraft, in that it will then block out the light of a bright star in our case, and then they can study the vicinity around it. I don't want to go too much technical detail, but you actually need very good optics because you've got a lot of light coming through your optical system that needs to be blocked, and that can very easily give you ghost images and stuff. So a coronagraph per se is not a simple instrument. So you say you have some on spacecraft.
Yes, I helped with a mission called Stereo, the last one that I remember anyway. It was a pair of spacecraft that were designed to look at the sun in 3D. So one was flying in front of the Earth as it goes around the sun, and one was flying behind the Earth as it goes around the sun. And we had a pair of coronagraphs on each spacecraft, as well as many other instruments that were designed to look at, as you pointed out, the coronagraph disk, I forgot what they call it, obstruction, is a black disk. And it has to be very carefully designed to simulate the moon, basically, and isolate the main light from the star, our sun, so that we can see these very faint things that are going on around the sun. And I think it's And if I recall correctly, some of the very first exoplanets were, as you mentioned, Vili, discovered by creating a coronagraph of stars so that you could see the very faint reflection of that starlight off of planets moving around those distant stars.
Yeah, the just interesting thing that I picked up is, well, the coronagraphs that I knew a bit about is that disk that blocks out the sun's light is, of course, inside the telescope. But by now, I know that astronomers can think very big, and some are already thinking about making a disk or a shade, a barrier, outside a telescope in space. And the telescope they consider is what is planned by NASA for early in the new decade, the Wide Field Infrared Survey Telescope. And this shield, or star shade rather, is supposed to fly about 25,000 miles, okay, 40,000 kilometers away from the telescope. So that's quite an interesting, I'm not sure how big that star shade will be, but to have the same angular size as the bright disk of the sun, it will have to have a corresponding size so that at the distance of 40,000 kilometers, it should be able to just block out the sun's brightest light and just reveal the corona. So that's quite interesting.
The size of the W1st coronagraph is going to be about the size of a football field, which is very much larger than the sunshade on JWST. Just think about that. The sunshade on JWST is about the size of a tennis court. So quite a lot of technology just going into blocking out the sun. So yeah, it's a very valuable instrument.
Okay, Jim, to answer any questions or so, you still prefer the Facebook group?
I'm always on the Facebook group. Love to answer questions there.
Mati, mense kan jou kontak?
Selfoonnommer 0836257154. 0836257154.
Ja, my telefoonnommer 0724579208. 0724579208. Die Facebookgroep Henny Maas en sy ruimtespan en die e-posadres sterreplanete@gmail.com. Nou ja, tot volgende keer wanneer ons weer die ontdekkingsreis deur die hemelruim voortsit.